and loading them up with snacks and messages to carry to women who were doing time down the hill. It was a bit like sending them off to a scary summer camp. Nina would be just a few hundred yards away behind that awful fence, but it might as well have been thousands of miles. I might never see her again. Along with the 7 other women, her duffel bag was loaded into the town driver's van, and I hugged her. "Thank you, Nina, for everything. The scarf's for you, Piper. I'm gonna finish it." Pop was crying. As Nina headed down the hill to the FCI, I felt a real sense of loss. She was the first real friend I had made, and I wouldn't have any contact with her at all. Prison is so much about the people who are missing from your life and who fill your imagination. Some of the missing were just across the prison grounds. I knew a half dozen women who had sisters or cousins down the hill in the high-security prison. One day, while walking back to work after lunch, I glimpsed Nina through the back gate of the FCI and went crazy, jumping up and down and waving. She saw me and waved too. The truck that patrolled the prison perimeter screeched to a halt between us. "Cut that shit out!" came sharply from the guard inside. Pop, who had spent many years down on the compound before being moved up to the camp, had enlisted multiple messengers to deliver treats to her friends still behind the wire. Living in A-dorm, the suburbs, Pop had an enormous locker in her cube, twice the size of mine and Natalie's. It was crammed with a bounty of her favorite things, food items like Spam that were no longer available on commissary, clothing from long ago that no one else had, and most important, perfume. She liked to mix her own. A little white diamonds, a little opium. Eau de Pop. "I'm almost done," said Pop, as she selected a few precious contraband lace brassieres to send to a friend doing life down the hill. "What am I hanging on to these for? I go home in January. I'll get pretty new bras for my jewels." Pop was a source of wonder and mystery and revelation. I didn't know it at the time, but Nina had set me up with a woman who would help me do my time in every sense of the word, who would baby me when I needed it most, and tell me to suck it up and get tough when there was no other option. She had cast a skeptical eye over me at first, but when I procured a wooden board from the CMS shop to put under her mattress for back support, her opinion of me improved significantly. My ability to write her furlough requests was also useful. But it was my voracious appetite for her cooking and her stories that won her over. Pop had lived a crazy life on the outside, arriving in this country from Russia at the age of 3. She was married out of her parents' house at 18 to a Russian gangster. Their life together had included all the excessive disco splendor of New York in the 1970s and 1980s, and several years on the run from the feds. "The feds tried to nail us every which way. My husband would just laugh. Well, if they wanted you bad enough, they're gonna get you. They don't ever give up." Her husband was in prison somewhere down south, and her children were grown now. She had lost everything, yet managed to take a dozen years in prison and hold it all together and make the best of it. Pop was cunning and exuberant. She was kind, but she could be ruthless. She knew how to work the system, and also how not to let them break you. And they were always trying. Pop's grown children came to visit her every week, along with several other family members, murmuring in Russian. The visiting room was the only place I ever saw her in regulation khaki uniform. Otherwise, she was always in her checked kitchen pants, burgundy smock with Pop embroidered on the breast in white yarn, and a hairnet. But for visits, she would always fix her hair and put on makeup, so she would look ladylike. Girlish, almost. Anyone who received visits on a regular basis usually maintained at least one uniform exclusively for these occasions. One that fit well, was kept pressed and stain-free, and in some instances was specially tailored. It was against prison rules to alter clothing in any way. But that never stopped anyone from trying to find ways to make the drab men's uniforms a bit more flattering, a bit more feminine. Some women would iron patterned folds into the backs of the boxy, billowy shirts. Everyone knew which inmates had sewing skills, and you could trade commissary goods for a better fit. The Spanish mommies particularly liked to wear their pants tight, tight, tight. I was thrilled when someone gave me a pair of the most desirable flat-front dickies, which had been taken in at the waist and tapered narrow at the ankle. The inner thighs were threadbare, but my fellow prisoners clicked their tongues approvingly as I sashayed to my visits. "P.I. Piper," my neighbor Delicious shouted appreciatively. "Brick house!" Larry agreed, his eyes popping when he first saw me in the tight pants. Hair was at least as important as unis. This was not an issue for a blonde, straight-haired gal like me. But for the black and Spanish women, it was the source of endless preoccupation and countless woman hours. You could generally tell who was expecting a visit by the state of their hair. There were frequent disputes about chair time in the salon room, played out against the overpowering smells of perm solution and burning hair. The electric supply for the room was insufficient for the demand, and the circuits tripped all the time. But reprehensible DeSimon refused to do anything about it.
"They ought to close that so-called beauty salon down," he snarled,
when the gals in the shop suggested that the electric crew might work on the wiring there.
"It's not working on these convicts."
Once a prisoner completed her coiffure, she could move on to makeup. Approximately a third of the population wore makeup almost every day, out of habit, as an effort to feel normal, or to be more alluring either to a staffer or another inmate. It was bought at the commissary, or in the case of one ex-stockbroker who was addicted to Borghese, smuggled in via a visitor. Before she left for the drug program, Nina gave me a little heart-shaped compact, the kind you might find at a dollar store, and I experimented with lurid eyeshadow colors. A significant percentage of the Spanish women had tattooed eyeliner, lip liner, and eyebrows, an effect I found unnerving. I associated it with Meatpacking District transsexual hookers. The tattooed brows never matched the real brows, which then had to be plucked or shaved, and with time, they would fade from black to blue. Almost everyone expecting a visit would present themselves pressed, coiffed, and painted on the landing next to the payphones, where you could see your loved ones approaching up the hill from the parking lot. Those who weren't expecting visits would plant themselves on the stairs anyway to observe the comings and goings as a source of vicarious entertainment. They could generally identify any regulars on sight.
"Oh, there's Ginger's kids. There's Angela's parents. He always drops her mom off before he parks. She's got a bad hip."
Visitors had to fill out a form stating that they had no firearms or narcotics on their person. The CO would then check the inmate's list to be sure that the visitor's name was on it. You had to hope that the list was up to date, something that was completely dependent on the inmate's counselor. Did he do his paperwork? Had he bothered to turn it in? If not, tough shit. It didn't matter who your visitor was or how far they had come to see you, they were not getting in. Larry told me how painful it was to watch every visitor, old or young, street punk or fancy yuppie, have to suck it up and kiss the prison guard's ass in the hope of culling some sort of favor. The power games that fueled so much of the prisoner guard experience extended to the visiting room. Larry came to see me every week, and I lived for those visits. They were the highlight of my life in Danbury, a chest-filling affirmation of how much I loved him. My mother drove 6 hours round trip until I begged her to come every other week. I saw more of her during the 11 months I was at Danbury than I had in all my previous adult years. Yoga Janet and Sister Platy always had a lot of visitors, aging counterculture hipsters and rosy-cheeked lefties in homespun Guatemalan cottons, respectively. Sister Platy was frustrated by the BOP's effective censorship of her visiting list. International peace figures had tried to gain permission to visit her and had been denied. Some women never got visits, because they had effectively said goodbye to the outside world. No children, no parents, no friends, nobody. Some of them were halfway around the world from home, and some of them didn't have a home. Some women stated flatly that they did not want their people to see them in a place like this. In general, the longer you were down, the fewer and farther between were your visits. I worried about my bunkie, Natalie, finishing her 8-year bid. She spoke to her young son on the phone every night and received many letters, but didn't have a single visit in the year we lived together. I observed the unspoken privacy wall we erected between us in our 7-by-10-foot space and never asked. Although each day often seemed endless, now each week came to an end before I expected it, hastened by visiting hours. I was remarkably lucky to have a visit from someone on Thursday or Friday, and also on Saturday or Sunday. This was a function of Larry and my mother's commitment, plus that of a large stock of friends in New York who were eager to come see me. Larry juggled my complex visiting schedule with cruise director aplomb. When my counselor, Butorsky, suddenly left, I feared another bureaucratic nightmare. He reportedly preferred early retirement to submitting to the will of Warden DeBoo, a much younger, non-northern female, and he was replaced with another lifer, Mr. Finn, who was also nearing the 20-year mark at the prison. Finn immediately made enemies among the camp prisoners and staff by demanding a private office and harassing the orderlies about the quality of their floor waxing. When he moved into his fancy private office, he placed a brass nameplate on the door. Of course, the damn thing disappeared immediately, which resulted in an army of COs coming in to shake down the camp. They would not rest until Officer Finn's nameplate was found. "You out of the frying pan and into the fire, Bunky," said Natalie, who knew Finn from previous years down the hill. "That man is nothing nice. At least Butorsky did his paperwork. Finn hates paperwork." This stressed me out, given the extensive visiting list juggling I was trying to perform. But my blonde hair and blue eyes stood me in good stead, just as they had with Butorsky. Mr. Finn was automatically inclined to like me, and when I approached with a new visitor's form and a timid request that maybe he would grant a special visit or shift my list around, as Mr. Butorsky had done, he snorted.
"Gimme that. I don't give a shit how many people you have on your visiting list. I'll put them all on."
"You will?"
"Sure." Finn looked me up and down. "What the fuck are you doing in here? We don't see women like you much."
10-year-old drug offense, Mr. Finn.
"What a waste. It's a waste for half of you people up in this camp. Most of you drug people shouldn't even be here. Not like those scumbags down the hill. There's one that killed her 2 kids. I think it's a waste to keep her alive."
I didn't know how to respond to that. "So you'll put that visitor on my list, Mr. Finn?"
"Sure."
And he did. My visiting list grew beyond 25 rapidly. Another example of the mystifying way that no prison rule was ever really cast in stone. Larry and my mother were my lifelines to the outside world, but I was also lucky enough to have friends who came to see me. Their visits were particularly refreshing because they weren't tinged with the guilty knowledge of what I was putting Larry and my family through. I could just relax and laugh my ass off as my friends brought news and questions and observations from their miraculously normal lives. David, my San Francisco book club buddy and Larry's ex-roommate, was a visiting room regular. He lived in Brooklyn now and would schlep up to Connecticut on the train once a month. What was especially wonderful about his visits was that he acted as if everything were perfectly normal, surveying the landscape with both curiosity and acceptance. He loved the vending machines. "Let's stroll over there and get a nosh." I wanted to weep at how my friends took my calamity in stride. David excited much attention at the camp. Perhaps it was his combination of red hair blasé charm and arty eyeglasses that attracted so much pointed comment. Or maybe they just weren't used to gay New York Jews in that neck of the woods.
"That's quite a friend you've got there,"
commented one of the male COs after a visit.
Leered Mr. Finn, "Just pretend I feel about women the way that buddy of yours from the visiting room does."
But the other prisoners loved David, who was always chatty with them.
"Did you have a good time today with your faggot friend?"
Pop asked after one of David's visits. "Of course I had."
"Faggots make the best friends," she said philosophically. "They're very loyal."
My dear friend Michael wrote to me every Tuesday on his beautiful Louis Vuitton writing paper. His letters seemed like artifacts of a distant and exotic culture. On his first visit to see me, he had the misfortune of arriving at the same time as the airlift transport bus, and he was treated to the sight of disheveled women in jumpsuits entering the FCI in full shackles, supervised by guards with high-gauge rifles. When I joined him at a card table, cheerful in my tidy khaki uniform, he looked shaken but relieved. Friends also came from Pittsburgh, Wyoming, and California to visit. My best friend Kristen left her new business in Washington to come see me every month, peering worriedly at my face for signs of trouble that others might not have caught. We have been inseparable friends since the first week of college. An odd pair, to be sure. She's a fairly proper Southerner, a straight arrow, an overachiever driven to please. I, a not-so-straight arrow. But deep down, she and I are very much the same. Similar families, similar values. Simpatico. She was going through a rough time. Her marriage was ending as her company was being born. And to have a heart-to-heart talk with her best friend, she had to haul ass to a Connecticut prison. I noticed that every time Kristen came to see me, Officer Scott would materialize in the visiting room and gaze at her like a teenage boy. Once a male friend came to visit me, a tall, curly-headed lawyer. He had been consulting with a pro bono client at a nearby men's prison, so he decided to stop by on his way home. Usually, he and his wife came to see me together. On that quiet Thursday afternoon, he and I had a grand old time, talking and laughing for hours. Afterward, Pop cornered me.
"I saw you in the visiting room. You looked like you were having some good time. So who is that guy? Does Larry know he's visiting you?"
I tried to keep a straight face while I assured Pop that my visitor was an old college friend of Larry's and that, yes, my fiancé knew about the visit. I wondered if Larry had any idea how many fans he had behind bars. When visiting hours were over, the last inmate stragglers hugged and kissed their loved ones goodbye, and we were left together, sometimes lost in our own thoughts, hoping the CO would be lazy and skip the strip searches. If someone was crying, you smiled sympathetically or touched their shoulder. If someone was grinning, you asked, "How was your visit?" as you unlaced your shoes. Once you were finished with squatting naked and coughing, you could burst back through the double doors into the rest of the camp building, onto the landing, where there were always lots of women loitering, waiting for the phones, and watching the visitors walk down the hill to the parking lots. If you were quick, you could dart to the window and catch one last glimpse of your visitor departing. Larry only told me later, when I was safe at home, how devastating it was for him to turn back and see me waving goodbye through the glass, and then to head back down the hill, leaving me alone. Chapter 8. So Bitches Can Hate. One hobby I did not pick up was crocheting, an obsession among prisoners throughout the system. Some of the handiwork was impressive. The inmate who ran the laundry was a surly rural white woman named Nancy, whose dislike for anyone but Northerners was hardly a secret. Her personality left a lot to be desired, but she was a remarkable crochet artist. One day in C Dorm, I happened upon Nancy standing with my neighbor Allie B and Mopey Sally, all howling with laughter.
What? I asked innocently. Show her, Nancy, giggled Allie.
Nancy opened her hand. Perched there in her palm was an astonishingly lifelike crochet penis. Average in size, it was erect, fashioned of pink cotton yarn, with balls and a smattering of brown cotton pubic hair and a squirt of white yarn ejaculate at the tip.
More sentimental than functional, I guess,
was all I could manage.
Allie B. lived several cubes down in B dorm and was a tall, skinny woman with broad shoulders and a strong jaw, who teetered between odd-looking and good-looking. She loved candy bars and reminded me of Wimpy from Popeye.
I will gladly pay you Tuesday for a Snickers bar today.
A daffy horn dog and an unrepentant junkie, she was counting the days out loud until she could go home, get laid, and score some junk, in that order. She was straightforward and unapologetic about her love of narcotics. Heroin was her drug of choice. But she was willing to get high on anything, and often threatened to sniff the solvents at her job in the construction shop. I didn't think there was anything there worth huffing.
Allie's sidekick was a young woman from western Pennsylvania who proudly called herself a redneck. I called her Pensatucky. One day, Pensatucky and I were standing at my cube in B dorm when my next-door neighbor Colleen and her pal Carlotta Alvarado walked by. Colleen had a big shit-eating grin on her face as she asked Carlotta, "So, what'd you think about that little toy I gave you last week? Pretty sweet, huh?" Carlotta laughed a rich, satisfied laugh, and they kept walking. I cocked an eye at Pensatucky.
"Dildos," she drawled in her backwoods twang.
I must have looked intrigued, because she hastened to explain. Colleen probably carved something nutty out of a carrot or something. Different than the usual.
Which is?
Pencil with an ace bandage wrapped around it. With one of them finger condoms from the infirmary over the whole deal.
Doesn't that sound enjoyable?
Huh. When I was locked up in county, they used to make dildos out of a spork, a maxi pad, and a finger from a rubber glove.
Another use for maxi pads revealed. The industrious hobbyists of the penal system would work with whatever materials they had.
Desperate times, desperate measures, huh, Pensatucky?
Whatever that means.
Just as we had sent 8 prisoners down the hill to the drug program, the FCI returned the favor in kind, with a fresh batch of hard-timers graduating up the hill. Sometimes these women were very close to release, and sometimes they still had a stretch of time to do. Regardless, they usually hung together for a time, quietly watching the situation, unless, of course, they had friends in the camp, either from the street or from the inside. One of the new arrivals from the FCI was Morena, a Spanish woman who looked like a deranged Mayan princess. Deranged not because she was unkempt or wild in her overall appearance. She had the clear air of someone who knows how to do time and was immaculately groomed with good unis, pressed and sharp, and she was generally very composed. But Morena had unsettling eyes. She would stare at you. Those crazy brown eyes were powerfully expressive, and you couldn't tell what the hell it was they were telegraphing. Whatever was going on in her head, it was taking a lot of effort for her to restrain it, and her eyes were giving her away. It wasn't just me who noticed her spooky eyes.
"That one's not right," said Pop, tapping her temple. "Watch it."
Imagine my surprise when Morena asked if she could walk with me in the morning to work. She had been assigned to the safety shop in CMS. I always chose to walk the half mile to work alone, a little freedom that I treasured. I had no idea what to talk to her about. I thought she was about my age, wasn't sure where she was from, her English was heavily accented and good, and I sure as hell wasn't going to start asking personal questions. "How do you like safety?" was pretty neutral. Crazy eyes couldn't take offense at that.
"It's fine," she snorted. "I know the boss from the FCI. It's no problem. Where are you from, chica?"
I gave her the standard bare minimum information. New York City, 15 months.
"You have children?"
"No children,"
Did she?
Morena laughed, a throaty, crazy laugh that said, Oh, you naive and innocent straight girl, you can't even tell that I'm a bulldagger on the outs, not just up in this joint where one cannot get any dick, and how I will relish turning you out.
No, baby, I got no children.
Over the next week or two, Morena was my companion on the walk to work, like it or not. I got an earful about her low opinion of the women in the camp.
They are like little girls. They think this shit is a game, she opined, curling her lip.
I was scrupulously polite and noncommittal because crazy eyes made me nervous. In addition to many halting conversations on the way to work, her interactions with me in the camp sharply increased. Morena would materialize at the entry of my cube and coo at me in a bizarre way.
Hello, baby.
I had decided when I moved into B dorm that I did not want anyone visiting me in my cube. The space was tiny and shared with Natalie, and was as close to privacy as I was going to get. I went out to socialize. If I was in my cube, I was either reading or writing letters or sleeping. Other women, especially the young ones, love to have people pile into their cubes, sit on their beds and footstools, and stand around and jaw. This was not for me.
Looks like you have a new friend, Bunky,
Natalie observed dryly. One day, while we were walking to work, Crazy Eyes cut to the chase. She was once again ranting about the immaturity and silliness of the women in the camp.
They act like they are on vacation here or something, running around and acting silly. They need to act like women.
I said, rather mildly, that most of the women were really bored, and perhaps not so well educated, and that they did indeed divert themselves with foolish things. This observation prompted a sudden and passionate declaration from Crazy Eyes.
Piper, they are like children, and I am looking for a real woman. I cannot be bothered with this bullshit, with these silly girls. On the street, I am a big-time drug dealer. I do serious business, big business. My life is serious. Even in here, I cannot waste my time with these silly bitches. I need a real woman.
I opened my mouth and then closed it. I felt like I had been dropped into a telenovela. Morena's bosom was practically heaving under her prison khakis. Hey, I could understand what she was saying. Her life was indeed serious. Her desires were serious. And I could understand why she didn't want to mess around with some trifling bimbo who was experimenting with lesbianism just to entertain herself in prison. But hell no, not me. I tried to choose my words with delicacy.
Well, Morena, I'm certain that you'll find the right woman for you. It just might take a while for her to show up, right?
She looked at me with those unreadable, crazy eyes. Was she pissed? Hurt? Vindictive? I couldn't tell. I was vastly relieved when we got to work. The 10-minute walk never seemed so long. I kept the conversation to myself. Morena made a few more attempts to express her need for a real woman, perhaps thinking that I was too dense to get her meaning. But my response remained the same. I was sure that the right woman was out there somewhere in the correctional system, and that Providence would deliver her to Danbury with all haste.
It wouldn't be fast enough for me.
Once it was clear that I was not her future boo, Crazy Eyes quickly lost interest in me. The companionable walks stopped, and the cubicle drop-bys ceased. She still greeted me, but in a disinterested way. I felt that I had navigated the situation with as much grace as I had available, and no hideous repercussions to my tacit rejection seemed forthcoming. I breathed a little easier, hoping Crazy Eyes would spread the word to the other committed lesbians that I was not like that. Even though, in some other lifetime, I had been. For the first time in many years, I was living a completely chemical-free existence, right down to going off birth control pills. My body was returning to its actual organic state. And after almost 3 months of enforced celibacy, I was feeling very warm under the collar. If you had spit on me, I might have sizzled. Larry was clearly feeling the pressure of our separation, too. His hello kisses in the visiting room grew more ardent, and he wanted to play footsie under the card tables. My own yearnings for footsie were severely tempered by my fear of the guards. I understood on a visceral level, as he did not, that they really could end a visit and take all my visiting privileges away. This point was demonstrated to Larry one day when gay porn star, also known as Officer Rotmanson, materialized during visiting hours. Gay porn star was a strutting sadist with a flat-top hairdo, close-set eyes, and a bristling mustache who resembled nothing so much as a Village People tribute band reject. He had come into the visiting room to see his little buddy, Officer Jesus Is My Homeboy, who was filling in for the regular visitation CO and boring two prisoners who were helpers in the visiting area with predictions about the rapture. As I entered the visiting room, I kissed Larry hello, and then he stole another kiss as we sat down at our assigned table. Seeing this, gay porn star bellowed across the room, pointing,
"Hey, one more time and you're out of here."
Every head turned to stare silently. Larry was rattled.
"What the hell is wrong with that guy?"
He tried to grab my knee under the table.
"That's just what they're like, darling. Don't touch me. He's not fucking around."
It killed me to snap at him like that when all I wanted was for him to touch me. But Larry didn't understand that pushing boundaries in prison can have dire consequences. These men had the power not only to end our visits, but to lock me up in solitary on a whim. My word against theirs would count for little. Afterward, still traumatized, I asked Elena, one of the prisoners who worked in the visiting room, what the hell had happened.
"Oh, the little guy was watching you and he was turning red," she said. "So Rotmanson got pissed off when he saw that his buddy was embarrassed seeing you kiss."
The next week, the regular CO was back on duty.
"I heard you were out of line last week," she said, patting me down before allowing me in to see Larry. "I'll be watching you."
In such a harsh, corrupt, and contradictory environment, one walks a delicate balance between the prison's demands and your own softness and sense of your own humanity. Sometimes at a visit with Larry, I would be overwhelmed, suddenly overcome with sadness about my life at that moment. Could our relationship weather this insanity? Larry had been steadfast for all those years waiting for me to go to prison. Now that I was here, could we make it through the real test? Our minutes in the visiting room were so precious, we could never bear to discuss anything difficult or negative. We wanted every second in that room to be sweet and perfect. Different women had different ways of dealing with prison's impact on their relationships. On a sleepy weekend afternoon, I stood by the microwave with my friend Rose Marie. She was in the midst of an elaborate cooking project, making gooey cheese and chicken enchiladas, and I was helping, although I could be counted on to chop an onion, tricky with a butter knife. Mainly, my help took the form of indulging her passion for talking about our future weddings. Rose Marie was engaged to a sweet, quiet guy who visited her faithfully every week, and she was obsessed with wedding planning. She had subscriptions to all the bridal rags, which piled up in her cubicle, and she loved to dream and scheme about her big day. She also wanted to plan for my big day. Larry and I had been engaged for almost 2 years. But I was hardly interested in a traditional ceremony, plus I knew we weren't getting married anytime soon, and this colored my willingness to take wedding planning very seriously, which drove Rose Marie nuts. When I told her I would wear a red bridal dress, she squealed with outrage. On this particular day, Rose Marie was preoccupied with my headgear. If I was not going to wear a veil, a shame, she thought, then a tiara was most advisable. I snorted.
"Rose Marie, do you really think I am putting a crown on my head to walk down the aisle?"
In the heart of a budding wedding planner, anything is possible. As Rose Marie filled tortillas and argued passionately in favor of seed pearls, Carlotta Alvarado approached. She wanted to know who was in line for the microwave. This was a strategic question. Carlotta, a committed system gamer, was assessing who would let her cut the line, and Rosemarie was a definite possibility. The two of them worked together training seeing-eye dogs, and while Carlotta, an around-the-way girl from the Bronx, and Rosemarie, a preppy geek from New England, didn't seem to have a lot in common, they got along very well. Rosemarie agreed to put the enchiladas on pause so Carlotta could fry some onions with saison, the Latin seasoning that makes everything orange, salty, and spicy.
Carlotta's engaged too, said Rosemarie as the onions sizzled. Engagements were rare around the camp.
That's great, Carlotta. What's your man's name?
Carlotta beamed.
Rick, he's my sweetie. He comes to visit me all the time.
Yeah, I'm getting married. I can hardly wait.
It's so exciting, sang Rosemarie.
Then she grinned.
Tell her what you told me, Carlotta.
Carlotta smiled triumphantly.
Yeah, I can't wait to get married. You know why?
I didn't.
Carlotta stepped back to better deliver the truth that when she contemplated holy matrimony made her heart beat faster. She pushed her palm toward me, index finger pointing skyward for emphasis.
So bitches can hate.
Bitches?
That's right. I'm going back to my neighborhood, and I'm going to get married, and that will show all those bitches who talk shit about me. I'll be married with my man, and you know what they'll have? No man. A bunch of babies by a bunch of guys. I cannot wait to get married so those bitches can just hate on me.
I studied Carlotta, her pretty face bright and animated as she envisioned her future, one that included her man, some bitches, and a ring around her finger. I was fairly certain that she would get what she wanted. Among all the women at the camp, she was the one who could always figure out an angle. She had a primo prison job training the service dogs. She had all the contraband onions she needed. She ran a side business doing pedicures, and rumor was that she even had a cell phone secreted somewhere in the prison, so she could call her man on the outside without waiting in line and paying the prison's sky-high rates. She was a smart cookie, with an unsentimental eye on the world. Rick, I concluded, was a lucky guy. As for me, I felt caught between the world I lived in now and the world to which I longed to return. I saw that those who couldn't come to terms with their imprisonment had a very difficult time with staff and with other prisoners. They were in constant conflict because they couldn't reconcile themselves with their fellow prisoners. I saw young women who had been running wild in poverty most of their lives rail against authority, and middle-aged, middle-class women who were aghast to find themselves living among people they thought were beneath them. I thought they were all unnecessarily unhappy. I hated the control the prison exercised over my life, but the only way to fight it was in my own head. And I knew I wasn't better than other women locked up in there, even the ones I didn't like. On the other hand, some people were way too comfortable in prison. They seem to have forgotten the world that exists on the outside. You try to adjust and acclimate, yet remain ready to go home every single day. It's not easy to do. The truth is, the prison and its residents fill your thoughts, and it's hard to remember what it's like to be free, even after a few short months. You spend a lot of time thinking about how awful prison is rather than envisioning your future. Nothing about the daily workings of the prison system focuses its inhabitants' attention on what life back on the outside as a free citizen will be like. The life of the institution dominates everything. This is one of the awful truths of incarceration. The fact that the horror and the struggle and the interest of your immediate life behind prison walls drives the real world out of your head. That makes returning to the outside difficult for many prisoners. So I became obsessed with the almost daily departures and found myself asking, who's going home this week? I kept a running tally in my mind, and if I liked the person, I would head up to the front door of the visiting room after breakfast to wave them off, a ritual observed by a gaggle of prisoners for every departure. It was bittersweet to watch them leave, because I would have given anything to be going with them. people planned their going home outfit, which someone from the outside would ship to receiving and discharge, R&D, for them. Their friends would prepare a special meal, and they would start to give away all their stuff, commissary clothing and good uniforms and blankets and other things of value that they had accumulated while doing their time. I fantasized about giving all my stuff away.
Watching people arrive was less pleasant but also interesting. I certainly felt bad for them, but my regard was tinged with a funny little sense of superiority, because at least I knew more about the workings of the camp than they did and thus had a leg up. This impulse was often proved wrong when someone turned out to be returning to Danbury after violating the terms of their probation. They would often march right into the counselor's office and ask for their old bunkie and job assignment back. I knew that as many as 2/3 of all released prisoners are locked up again, a fact that mystified me at first. There was no way they would get me back in prison. Ever. And yet, no one ever seems surprised to see a familiar face return to Danbury. Self-surrenders who came to the camp were easy to spot. They were usually white and middle class, and looked totally overwhelmed and scared to death. I would ask myself, did I look that wigged out? And then I'd go get them some of the extra shower shoes and toothpaste I now kept stashed in my locker for such occasions. But most new arrivals had been in custody for a while, sometimes since their initial arrest, if they had not been granted bail or couldn't make the bail payment. And they were coming from county jails or from federal jails, called MCCs or MDCs, Metropolitan Correctional Centers or Metropolitan Detention Centers. The county jails were described to me as universally nasty, full of drunks, prostitutes, and junkies, not up to the standards of us federales. No shock, then, that the women arriving at Danbury from county usually looked fried. They seemed happy to get to Danbury because the conditions were better. That depressed me. Also intriguing were the women like Morena, who had earned their way up the hill from the high-security FCI to the minimum-security camp. In theory, the really hardened and potentially dangerous criminals. They were always very composed in terms of physical appearance. Hair done and uniforms just so, with their own name and reg number embossed on the shirt pocket. Campers didn't get that. They never looked scared, but they were often freaked out because they were unaccustomed to as much freedom as we were afforded, and they reported that there was far less to do in the camp in the way of programs and recreation. In fact, many of them were miserable in the camp and wanted to go back to max lockup. One woman, Coco, marched right into the counselor's office and explained that she couldn't handle the freedom, and would they please send her back down the hill, because she didn't want to lose her good time due to an escape attempt. I heard that the truth was she couldn't stand to be apart from her girlfriend, who was still down in the FCI. Coco was sent back the next day. Spring was coming slowly to the Connecticut hills, and we were starting to shake off the cold. Being cooped up with so many wackos was affecting my worldview, and I feared that I would return to the outside world a bit cracked too. But I was learning something every day, resolving some new subtlety or mystery through observation or instruction. The track by the fieldhouse gym was now mush, but I slogged determinedly around it, encouraged by the fact that I kept getting thinner and thinner, and every visitor who came to see me said with astonishment, "You look fantastic." I was making those mucky circles in silence, because the commissary was still out of the damn crappy headset radios that cost $42. Every week I put the radio on my shopping list before I turned it in, and every week, no radio. The commissary CEO, who was a real prick in public and friendly in private, just barked, "No radios," when I asked when they would get some. All the other new arrivals were in the same boat, and we commiserated bitterly. Movie night was all about reading lips for me, and my time on the track or in the gym left me with my thoughts echoing noisily in my skull. I had to have that radio. Lionel, the inmate consigliere of the warehouse, was one of my closest neighbors in our cramped quarters.
Her bunkie had been the target of Lily Cabrales's protest pee on my first morning in B dorm, and it was she who had sopped up the puddle. Lionel had a black name plaque like Natalie's, indicating that she had been down the hill in the FCI and probably had a long sentence. She was formidable, but still friendly, a no-nonsense player when it came to doing time, and a cheerful Christian who was quick with a wry observation. Lionel was vocal about what you might call community issues, not stealing, acting right during count, treating other prisoners with respect. She wasn't about to go out of her way to befriend a random white girl like me, but she would still say good morning and occasionally smile at my attempts at humor when we found ourselves side by side at the bathroom sinks. One quiet afternoon, as I was fixing lights in B dorm, Lionel materialized outside her cube. This was unusual, as she would normally be at work in the warehouse. I seized the opportunity to find out more about the mysterious radios.
Lionel, I hate to bother you, but I've got a question.
I quickly explained my radio problem.
I'm going crazy with no music. I just can't get the CO to tell me when they're coming in. What do you think?
Lionel gave me a skeptical, sidelong look.
You know you're not supposed to ask warehouse folks about that. We're not allowed to talk about any goods in the warehouse.
I was taken aback. No, Lionel, I didn't know that. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I'm sorry.
No problem.
May was a week away. The sun was starting to make itself known now, drying up the mud. There were leaves on the trees, migratory birds, and tons of baby bunnies all over the track. I realized that it wasn't so bad to be listening to my own thoughts when there was so much to look at. I had made it 3 months, almost a quarter of my sentence. If I had to watch silent movies for the next 10, so be it. I almost didn't bother putting the radio on my commissary list that week. Someone who had already shopped was complaining that they were still out. So when a new radio headset came flying past the register to land in my grocery pile, I just stared at it.
Is there something wrong with you, Kerman? Shouted the CO. It's true what they say about blondes, huh?
I looked past him, into the glassed-in commissary, and spotted Lionel. She didn't meet my eye. I just smiled to myself as I signed my receipt and handed it back to him. It was funny how things worked around here, how other prisoners could make things happen. I wasn't really sure what I had done right, but did it matter? That week, the entire population of the camp was summoned into the main hallway for an impromptu meeting with the staff, a bunch of white men looking too bored to smirk. We were told, 1, your sanitation is wanting. We will hold more inspections. 2, no smoking under the unit manager's window. You have been warned. 3, no sex in the camp. No exceptions. Zero tolerance. This means you. We were collectively unimpressed. All of us prisoners knew that Finn, the senior counselor, was way too lazy to bother inspecting the dorms beyond the bare minimum and didn't care enough to enforce most rules. The only thing Finn did appear to care about was hierarchy, as demonstrated to us by the nameplate fiasco. And the administrative unit manager didn't give a rat's ass about anything having to do with the camp. True to the staff's charges against us, though, there had been quite an uptick in sexin among the ladies since Butorsky's departure, which led to some comical matchups. Big Mama was a cheerful Leviathan who lived in A dorm, quick with a play on words, generally benevolent, and prodigious in girth. She was slim on modesty, however, as was proven by her shameless sexin with a series of much younger, much skinnier girls in her open cubicle. I liked Big Mama and was fascinated by her romantic success. How did she do it? What were her tricks? Were they the same as those employed by fat middle-aged men to get young, nubile girls to sleep with them? The girls didn't then turn around and disrespect her, so was it curiosity on their part? I was curious, but I wasn't quite brave enough to ask. There was a constant dance between the prisoners and the staff around the rules.
With a new rotation of officers on detail in the camp, the dance would start anew. I was washed in relief to be rid of gay porn star. It was amazing how much more bearable it was around the camp with him gone. In porn star's place, we now had Mr. Maple, who seemed to be his predecessor's exact opposite. Mr. Maple was young, recently out of the military after service in Afghanistan, and exaggeratedly courteous and friendly. He was instantly popular with the women of the camp. I still considered all COs the enemy on principle, but I was beginning to understand a bit better why a prisoner might look at them with anything other than a baleful eye. Regardless of gay for the stay, the vast majority of female prisoners are heterosexual, and they miss male companionship, male perspective, and male attention. A fortunate minority have a husband or a boyfriend who visits regularly, but most are not so lucky. The only men they come in contact with are prison guards, and if the CO is a half-decent human being, he will find himself the object of crushes. If he is a cocky bastard, even more so. It is hard to conceive of any relationship between two adults in America being less equal than that of prisoner and prison guard. The formal relationship, enforced by the institution, is that one person's word means everything and the other's means almost nothing. One person can command the other to do just about anything, and refusal can result in total physical restraint. That fact is like a slap in the face. Even in relation to the people who are anointed with power in the outside world, cops, elected officials, soldiers, we have rights within our interactions. We have a right to speak to power, though we may not exercise it. But when you step behind the walls of a prison as an inmate, you lose that right. It evaporates, and it's terrifying. And pretty unsurprising, when the extreme inequality of the daily relationship between prisoners and their jailers leads very naturally into abuses of many flavors, from small humiliations to hideous crimes. Every year, guards at Danbury and other women's prisons around the country are caught sexually abusing prisoners. Several years after I came home, one of Danbury's lieutenants, a 17-year corrections veteran, was one of them. He was prosecuted and spent 1 month in jail. When Mr. Maple was on duty in the evening, he constantly patrolled the dorms. There was something unnerving to me about the male COs seeing me in nothing but my muumuu, billowing though it was. It was more unnerving still when I would look up from changing after the gym, in shorts and a sports bra, to see the eyes of a prison guard. It wasn't so much the idea of them seeing my body, although the thought made me recoil. It was more the idea that my intimate moments, changing clothes, lying in bed, reading, crying, were all, in fact, public, available for observation by these strange men. On one of his early days on duty, Maple was running through mail call.
Platy, Platy, Rivera, Montgomery, Platy, Esposito, Piper.
I stepped up and he handed me my mail, and I turned back to the crowd to rejoin it. Some of the women were tittering and whispering. I stood next to Annette and looked at her quizzically.
He called you Piper.
Other prisoners were looking at me with curiosity. It wasn't done. I felt embarrassed and showed it by flushing deeply, which provoked more tittering.
He just doesn't know. He thinks it's my last name, I explained defensively.
The next day at mail call, he did it again.
That's her first name,
some wise ass said pointedly, as I blushed again.
Is it? He asked. That's unusual.
Still, he kept calling me Piper. Chapter 9. Mothers and Daughters. Mother's Day was off the chain at the camp. From the moment we awoke, every woman wished another Happy Mother's Day, repeatedly. I quickly gave up explaining that I had no children and just said, Happy Mother's Day to you. About 80% of the women in U.S. prisons have children, so odds were I was right. A lot of women had crocheted long-stem red roses for their prison mamas or friends. Some women organized themselves into somewhat formalized family relationships with other prisoners, especially mother-daughter pairs. There were a lot of little clans at Danbury. The younger women relied on their moms for advice, attention, food, commissary loans, affection, guidance, even discipline. If one of the younger ones was misbehaving, she might get directed by another irritated prisoner, "Go talk to your mama and work your shit out." Or if the kid was really out of control with her mouth or her radio or whatever, the mama might get the request, "You need to talk to your daughter, because if she don't get some act right, I'm gonna knock her out." My de facto prison family revolved around Pop. It exemplified the complex ways that family trees grow behind bars, like topiaries trained into very odd shapes. My immediate sibling was Tony, the new town driver who had replaced Nina as Pop's bunkie. By automatic extension, Rose Marie, Tony's best buddy, was another sibling. I thought of them as the Italian twins. But Pop had many other children, including Big Boo Clemens, the even bigger Angelina Lewis, and Yvonne, who worked with Pop in the kitchen. I took a particular liking to Yvonne. We called each other the sister I never wanted. All of Pop's black daughters called her Mama. All of the white ones called her Pop. She didn't have any Spanish daughters, though she did have Spanish pals from her own peer group. Motherhood in prison was revered but also complicated by separation, guilt, and shame. To my eye, my fellow prisoners were mostly ordinary poor or middle-class mommies, grandmas, and even great-grandmothers. And yet, some of them were serving very long sentences, 5 years, 7 years, 12 years, 15 years. I knew that by virtue of being in the minimum security camp, they were unlikely to have been convicted of violent crimes. As I watched my neighbors, young women who lacked even a high school education, with their children in the visiting room, I found myself asking again and again in my head, what could she possibly have done to warrant being locked up here for so long? Criminal masterminds, they were not. In the 3 months since my arrival in Danbury, I had seen a number of pregnant women become mothers. In February, young Doris was the vessel of my first prison nativity. I had never seen a woman in labor before, and was both mesmerized and horrified to watch Doris enter a zone in which her body and her baby were taking over, regardless of surroundings. To my fascination, the population of the camp snapped to attention and stepped in to help her as much as anyone could. She had a half dozen surrogate midwives hovering over her at any given moment, checking to see what she needed, coaching her on how to get more comfortable, relating stories of their own labors and reporting on her progress to an anxious audience of prisoners. The staff certainly wasn't paying much attention to what was happening. Prison births were no big deal to them. It was Doris's first child, and all she wanted to do was curl up in her bunk, which apparently was not a good thing for her or the baby struggling to be born. Older women took turns walking with her up and down the long main hall of the camp, talking to her gently, telling stories and cracking jokes. Observing keenly was Doris's roommate, also heavy with her first child and due any day. They both looked scared. The next morning, as the contractions were growing closer, Doris was taken off to the hospital in handcuffs. In many places in the United States, pregnant female prisoners are kept chained in shackles during their deliveries, a brutal and barbaric practice, though this was not the case for poor Doris. After many hours of labor, she gave birth to a 9-pound baby boy in Danbury Hospital and was brought back to prison immediately, pale and drawn and sad. Her mother took the baby back to the rural outpost where she lived, 8 hours away. There wasn't much chance that the new arrival would see his father anytime soon. Doris told me that her baby's daddy had just been picked up on 3 outstanding warrants. Fortunately, she was due to go home within the year. I hadn't witnessed anything at Danbury to allay my fear of childbirth. But for the first time, I had some tiny insight on the mother-child relationship.
The single most reliable way to get another prisoner to smile was to ask her about her children. There were always families in the visiting room. This was both the best and the worst thing about the many hours I spent there. Young children were growing up while their mothers did time, trying to have a relationship via 15-minute phone calls and the hours spent in visitation. I never saw these women look happier than when they were with their children, playing with the small collection of plastic toys kept in the corner and sharing Fritos and Raisinets from the vending machine. When visiting hours were over, it was gut-wrenching to watch the goodbyes. In 1 year, a child could change from a squirming baby to a boisterous, talkative toddler, and mothers would watch football championships and prom nights come and go from the distant sidelines, along with their children's graduations, wedding days, and funerals. As tough as it could be for a prisoner to visit with her children, it was also hard for parents to see their babies locked up. There were so many young girls among us, 18 and 19 years old. Some of these kids had been heading to a place like Danbury for some time, but one bad decision could suddenly land a young